everyone. Welcome to episode 29 of the Johnny and Josh Show. 29, as you know, is a very special number, not just my lucky number, given I was born on July the 29th, but also, boys, it would take 29 million years for a car traveling 100 miles per hour to reach the nearest star. Talking of stars, I'm joined by the legends that are Eric, the producer, and JC. How are you, boys?
Goldie, I would love to go back and rewind the tape. I think every week you say it's a special number. Is every number is special in its own way, right?
Well, it's funny because every time I look up what's so unique about a certain number, they always start off with, "Oh, it's so special." And I didn't need convincing, given the fact that 29 genuinely is my lucky number, having been born on the 29th. So I thought that was rather lovely. And in fact, the biblical meaning of 29 apparently indicates simply the beginning, which of course couldn't be more inappropriate for this show because we're into the postseason and we're nearing the end. But there you go.
Well, we're close to the beginning of the World Series, which is the beginning of the end.
Okay. We'll go with that.
That a little twisted? I think I twisted it just a smidge. Yeah.
It works for me, buddy. Okay. Playoff fever. How exciting. I'm assuming, Eric, you're up to all hours watching every game.
Yeah, and it's a tough time as well if you're a hockey fan as well. The NHL has started. If you're an NFL fan, the NFL started, of course, weeks ago. And playoff fever, yes, it is indeed playoff fever and sleepless nights galore.
And speaking of things that I love, Eric, how you are always inappropriate. So you post on social media a picture of a hockey game and a picture of playoff baseball and describe it as Sophie's Choice. Mike, did you see the movie Sophie's Choice?
Yeah, they both die.
Exactly.
Oh, sorry. Spoiler alert.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm like, seriously, Eric? I mean, you know.
Oh, come on. I think
you're balancing, you know, the importance of your sports consumption incorrectly.
That's true. I'll admit it's an extreme allegory, isn't it?
It's important not to take sport too seriously, guys, especially if you're a rugby fan and you've sat at the Rec this afternoon.
Moving on.
And watch Bath. Did you see the score? Did you see the score?
I feel like you're always making a left turn when we want to make
If there's a drinking game for this podcast, Johnny's first mention of rugby, people are already pissed now.
I'm just doing this for Daniel's sake. Our good friend Daniel is always going on about me mentioning rugby, so I just thought I'll fly it out there. When your team's lost 71-17 at home, I think you're worthy of any mention. Anyway, moving on, too painful. Let's talk about notable 29s. And there's one very notable 29, and that is, of course, Rod Carew, who had 29 retired, not just with the Twins, but with the Angels as well.
Shockingly, I mean, one of the greatest players of all time, great contact hitter, one of my favorite players, but I actually don't think he's the best hitting 29 of all time. And the person who would get that credit for me is Adrian Beltre, who is not eligible for the Hall of Fame yet, still has a couple more years left, but all around, over 3,000 hits, a 20-year career that started at the age of 19. He didn't even play into his 40s, and he still had put up amazing numbers and great defensively, five-time Golden Glover. Didn't like to get touched in the head, though. I don't know if you've seen all the videos of that, like of his teammates trying to pat him on the head, and he went absolutely crazy with it.
Yeah, he goes ballistic when he gets touched on the head. It's his quirk. Don't touch my head.
It's one of the funny, I mean, look up the videos. You shouldn't laugh at anyone's quirk, but, you know.
He definitely was a bit quirky, wasn't he? He hated the Gatorade as well. I remember there was one story about him grabbing a broom to make sure after he'd hit a home run, I think it was a grand slam, and he knew that they were probably going to come out. So he grabbed a broom and sort of, you know, fend them off. He was a character. But his longevity, not just his talent. I mean, I think he started with the Dodgers when he was just 19. And he was still playing baseball 20 years later, and his numbers are off the charts. I'm assuming, JC, you're going to say he's a first-round balloter for Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I would argue that he's a top five all-time third baseman.
And he should be going to the Hall of Fame just for one reason alone, and that is because he has good taste in delicatessens. Dodgers were in town.
You sound just like Gouldie. I mean, we're going to get a right turn. You turn left to talk about yourself.
It's valid. It's valid because it's more about Adrian Beltre. He was, I'll never forget, after a Dodgers Expos game in Montreal, I was leaving the Olympic Stadium, and then Jason Wirth and Adrian Beltre stopped me and goes, "Hey, do you know which is the best place to get a smoked meat sandwich here in Montreal?" And I said, "Follow me." And I said, "Wow, I can't believe I'm giving directions to a future MVP to where the, you know, which, by the way, is the Main on St. Lawrence Street, across the street from Schwartz's. Don't go to Schwartz's.
Lester's. Go to Lester's.
Yeah, it's Lester's. A bit far, too far up north Montreal. But anyways, yeah, bottom line, Adrian Beltre, he gave him directions of where to get the best smoked meat in town.
If we're doing drinking games, another drinking time would be when one of us tells a tangentially relevant self-aggrandizing story. That would definitely, I mean, Gould, you do it, but Eric, you're there, I'm there. David's the king of that. We're all there.
We would just have 700, 1,000 very drunk listeners if we did that. So I don't think we should be encouraging.
What I love about that is if we just turn ourselves into a drinking game, we would increase our listeners, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Let's just call us, you know, the baseball drinking game. Send out a bingo card and just, you know, get everyone.
Hey, listen, there used to be on television, there used to be a Channel 5 drinking game.
I remember that.
And I was looking online, and if anybody can remember where to find the drinking game was, and I think that one of them was like for 100, no, like two shots of vodka or something, was when Johnny and Josh make fun of Eric, and that was like that's what I had to say. Careful, that's very dangerous.
The best were all of Gouldyisms, right? Bish Bosh, back at the net, Fan Dabby Dozy,
hardcore was another one. Yeah, absolutely. But moving on.
We can't move on. I'm sorry, we cannot move on without another notable 29 getting a mention.
Yeah, John Smoltz, great player. Moving on.
Excuse me. Playoff history. This is when it matters. He posted a record of 15-4 with a 2.67 ERA in 41 career postseason games. That is a man who delivers when the chips are down and when the stakes are high. Moving on, COVID update. Yeah. So far, so good from a postseason perspective. What's happening with the Canadian border, Eric?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the NHL season has started and full capacity arenas, which is wonderful to see, wonderful to hear. And not if you're a Montreal fan, shut up. At the moment, yeah, there's still the Canadians cannot cross the U.S. border. Soon, they're saying early November. The problem is, and here's where it ties in nicely, I'm actually wearing a Seattle Pilots jersey. Now, Johnny, you may ask, Seattle Pilots, who the hell are they? You'll see, the Seattle Pilots eventually became the Milwaukee Brewers. They only lasted one season. And the interesting story is that they decided, it's right up in doing spring training, are they going to stay in Seattle or are they going to move to Milwaukee? It was a week before the season started that they decided, okay, the Seattle Pilots will now move to Milwaukee. They'll become the Milwaukee Brewers. And there was no time to make a new uniform. So they just took the Pilots template jerseys, put Brewers over it, kept the yellow captain's bars for a few seasons. And that's why the Milwaukee Brewers still have the blue and yellow color motif.
If you look at the baseball cards too that year, they actually hand painted in the Brewers hats because they still had Pilots hats because they had taken pictures from when they were the Seattle Pilots, and they had to turn it into Milwaukee Brewers hats.
Quick question: Why would you not just become the Milwaukee Pilots? Why would you change the whole name, not just the city, but the actual name reference?
So what's the connection? I mean, the Pilots made a lot of sense for Seattle, right? It's where Boeing was located, the famous, you know, big jumbo airliner manufacturer. But there's nothing pilot-y about Milwaukee Brewers. Now you got something going.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, but the Brooklyn Dodgers became the LA Dodgers.
But that's because you had, you
know, the Giants became the San Francisco Giants.
Right, because you had 80, 90 years of history associated with it. We're talking about a 1 year of history.
Seattle Pilots, right?
Exactly. And of course, the great player on that team, Jim Bouton, who wrote Ball 4.
Who wore number 56, exactly.
There you go, yeah. You're wearing the jersey.
Jim Bouton's jersey. Of course, and the man responsible for the move of the Seattle Pilots to the Milwaukee Brewers, Bud Selig, there you go.
Yeah, who was commissioner.
By the way, I'm not wearing a Seattle Pilots cap. This is why it ties nicely with what I was saying before. If only I can get to David Langell's house, because of course I mail ordered many things to go to his house, so I don't pay customs fees and excess fees to come over to here in London. And so a Seattle Pilots cap is actually in his house, but I've only got the jersey.
I'm waiting for customs officials who listen to our podcast to send you a.
I didn't break any
bill.
Law. I didn't, just because it never arrived. So, yeah. But that's
that would just be Sod's Law, wouldn't it?
Oh, oh God, it would be so sad. Be total so, face. Yeah, I'm sure a lot handed of face.
Anyways, David Leggo can't be with us tonight, and I was hoping he would be so we can wear the Seattle Pals cap that I ordered. So I wear the jersey, he wears the cap. Anyways, moving on.
Okay, well, as always, we do want you to get involved with the show. We're going to big up the social media now. We're back on YouTube. So do check out our channel, The Johnny and Josh Show, whether it's on Twitter or on Facebook. Hit the buttons at the below us. Like, subscribe, whatever it is that you haven't done already, do it now. We do want you to get involved. And, of course, talking about getting involved, it's time for Eric's trivia question. What have you got for us this week, big guy?
My question to you, gentlemen, now we're talking about, like, retired numbers, right? We're talking about... you mentioned Rockaroo and all that kind of stuff, and but since the NFL are in town again, and since the NHL season started, I thought I'd ask you this question: which of these teams actually have the most retired numbers? Is it A, the New York Yankees? Is it B, the Montreal Canadiens? Yes, of the NHL.
Oh, so now you're going outside of baseball. This question is...
Is it C, Chicago Bears? Or is it D, the Boston Celtics? So all four sports there. Does baseball have the most? Does the New York Yankees own the most retired numbers?
I love the Eric Stumper. It is normally really great. This one's... You're inching out of the baseball.
I've branched out.
Yeah,
I'm trying to get the other sports involved and all this. So yes,
cross promotional.
Buddy, I don't know about you, Eric, but it's abundantly clear that JC's struggling. He confidently predicts he's going to get these questions right, and this week he knows he's in trouble. Welcome to my world, JC.
It's a dark place, Gouldie.
Right, ring that bell.
Anyways, just to reiterate, which of these four teams actually have the most retired numbers? Was it A, the New York Yankees? B, the Montreal Canadiens, C, the Chicago Bears, or D, the Boston Celtics. Moving on.
Okay, well, the postseason so far is, of course, first batter. We've switched things up for the postseason. As we know, Major League Baseball doesn't like any mention of anything that's going to sort of take you outside of postseason, but there's all sorts of things to cover. And of course, the first thing we want to talk about is the divisional series from the AL and NL. We're going to talk first of all, guys, about the Rays and the Red Sox. What a series it was, and not short of controversy. JC, I want your thoughts on the Kevin Kiermaier hit, which, as we know, then hit Renfro in the outfield, went into the crowd, ruled a ground rule double. Definitely a score, or a run would have scored, but for the ground rule double, of course, isolated the hitter at third base. Well, I mean, technically, it is the rule, but it's abundantly clear it's the wrong rule. What's your thoughts?
Well, I don't know if it's the wrong rule. In this instance, it feels that way because there was a runner on with two outs. Runners breaking on contact would have scored. Interestingly, Kevin Cash, the manager for the Rays, invoked that rule to his favor in a previous game in the past. So it was a rule that he was certainly familiar with. You live by the sword, die by the sword, and it has an impact. I think it should be a little, there should be a little more discretion in this sort of situation, that, you know, if you believe the run's going to score, that he gives the umpire that discretion. But discretion is always a little bit of a slippery slope, right? If you have a hard and fast rule, a bright line, it just makes it easier to take the pressure off of an individual subjective decision. So, but you know, people aren't happy, understandable. Keep in mind though, Kike Hernandez hits a 2-run home run. Red Sox potentially would have won that game even if that run had have scored, although I think mentality changes when you're down by one instead of a tie score. So huge impact on the game. Ultimately, though, rules are rules. If you want to change it in the future, change it. But for now, I don't think, you know, there shouldn't be too much hemming and hawing about it.
And I have to say, having watched the video on a number of occasions, it's abundantly clear that it was an accident. He hasn't sort of deliberately knocked it out. It was, you know, it was genuine. I mean, if you watch the replay, so it's just unfortunate. As sorry as I feel for the Rays, I think they just got to accept it's a bad bounce, and it happens. Unfortunately, are you surprised by the fact that they've lost 3-1?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a longtime Red Sox supporter. I spent my whole life since I was a little kid rooting for the Sox. And Oh, since they've become an ascendant team and the bandwagon's gotten absurd in 2004, it's sometimes hard to root for them because, you know, the teams were so good. And, you know, other than that 2014, which were the idiots and, you know, they probably overachieved to get there. A lot of the other Red Sox teams that have been successful have been, you know, front runners a little bit. This is a great team because they're not that kind of front runner team. That they're overachieving, and it brings back my memories of my childhood about Red Sox teams you could root for that you weren't expecting them necessarily to go all the way. So I'm having a lot of fun with it. You know, I don't think they have all the parts. I mean, Chris Sales, you know, he was good right when he came back. He's been a little up and down. Evaldi's been quite good, so that's useful. That bullpen's been a little bit patchworked, but it's been solid. So you know, it's just gonna. The great thing about the postseason, right? If you get some players on a hot streak, you can continue to surprise. And that's what the Red Sox are going to need. You know, Devers was having some shoulder issues. He hits a grand slam in his in the second game of that series against the Astros in the championship series. So can't rule them out for a World Series run, but they are overachieving.
Okay, well, let's move on to the White Sox and the Astros. You weren't at all surprised. You predicted Houston would win that. Just as a question mark from a Chicago White Sox perspective, is there any inkling that La Russa might lose his job as a result of this result?
La Russa said that he wants to come back. He said if the players want him back, I would be surprised. There's baseball is a trend game, right? And we've had the trend towards the young managers. Now we're having a trend back towards older managers. You know, Dusty's done so well. The team's done well with La Russa, but you know how I feel about this. You know, he called out Lance Lynn. You had Mercedes, you know, you've got all these issues with him and not having copacetic in the clubhouse that I would think that a move might make sense here, but you know, I'm not inside there, so I don't know for certain.
And it did seem that they were completely outplayed by the Astros. So, disappointment. I mean, I predicted that they would win the American League Championship Series, and they were never really at the races on this one. So that was disappointing. Okay, well, let's focus on the NLDS. And we've got to start with San Francisco and LA. I mean, clearly the best series, went the full five games, and in the end decided by a one-run victory. And you got a feel for the Giants, the season they've had, you know, best record in Major League Baseball, winning the pennant, and yet still not getting beyond the divisional series. And there was more controversy, the check swing controversy. What's your thoughts on that?
Gouldy, it's really interesting, right? Because we talked about the Kiermaier hit and how that was the bright line letter of the law that determine that play. And this is the exact other side of the spectrum here. When we're talking about a situation where it's something so subjective in baseball, in fact, the check swing is one of the most subjective elements of baseball. You could talk to an umpire or a positional player or a pitcher, and they're all going to give you a different determination of what is actually swinging at this sort of pitch. Is it when you break your wrist? Is it when the bat head gets out in front of the knob of the bat? And my feeling about this, I saw one person suggest this, that any check swing should not be a strike unless you fully offer, unless you take a full swing. And I kind of like that suggestion, right? We've talked about how pitchers have so many different advantages right now in baseball, that if you take this one away, that maybe it gives hitters a little bit more of an advantage, that they can be a little bit more aggressive. And as long as they don't fully swing, as long as they don't fully go through the swing, that all of a sudden the hitters get a slightly better advantage. So I would like to see a little bit more of a bright line here because it puts too much pressure on the umpire. There's no way to go to instant replay in order to sort this out. And I know the umpire was like, you know, it was the spur of the moment and it's what I saw. And that's pretty difficult.
The basis of the rule as it stands right now, you said it yourself, the hitter has to offer. That's the only line that they offer in terms of guidance for the ruling. Having seen it, did you feel that he offered? It was what Wilmer Flores.
No, I don't think so at all.
So the Giants were stiff a bit on this occasion.
Yeah, 100%. But you know, again, it's a difficult situation. What you're allowed to do as a hitter, you can't if the plate umpire calls it a strike on the swing, the hitter cannot ask the first base umpire or the third base umpire, the umpire who is unobstructed, depending on whether it's a left-handed or right-handed hitter, whether or not the plate umpire got it wrong. So the hitter has no recourse, but the pitcher does. So what often happens, I did this all the time as a catcher, is that you'll always ask the base umpire to check. They have a better angle to see whether the hitter is offered. But still, they're more than 90 feet away, and it's very easy to get that wrong. And I got it wrong on this instance, but, you know, it's tough. It's tough. And that's why creating a little bit more of a bright line rule would take a little pressure off the umpires. And this is one that even if you had mechanical umpires, you'd have to have an instant replay because, again, there's no direct rule about what creates an offer in terms of a check swing.
So you think the most important thing that should come from this is a clear rule needs to be established that this is too subjective.
Yeah, and I think an interesting rule would be that you have to fully offer, in other words, take a full swing. Anything short of that, anything short of fully swinging, if it's the pitch was not in the strike zone, then it's a ball. And I think a lot of people would bristle at that, but that would be an advantage for the hitters, and at a time where pitchers have the advantage, might be the way to go.
Okay. Interesting. Scherzer getting his first save. Very clearly that Mr. Roberts, the LA manager, is quite happy thinking outside the box in terms of what he does with his pitchers. His first career save. I mean, that must be pretty downhearted for any Giants fans when you see Max Scherzer coming in.
Well, I mean, he was pitching on very short rest. I think there's been so much criticism of Dave Roberts. And, yeah, I mean, it's just, again, such a pastime to criticize managers. And I think he's done a great job. I think back 10 years ago that you would pitch by committee in these games that matter so much, or in that instance, in the deciding game, not start your 20-game winner and bring him in the middle of the game to try and have a tactical advantage in terms of lefties and righties. You know, Urias came in later in that game instead of starting that. And those are really dangerous decisions because they go against the orthodoxy of baseball. And yet they worked out. And I think that maybe there needs to be a reevaluation about how good a manager Dave Roberts is, because he's pulled some really good strings, I think, so far in this postseason.
Yeah. Okay, well, moving on to the final NLDS, and that was, of course, the Atlanta Braves v. the Milwaukee Brewers. First thing I want to say is, having watched pretty much all the games, how amazing I think the Brewers fans are. The atmosphere for their home games was off the charts. Absolutely spectacular. Great excitement. And this is a stat for you, for us Braves fans that are hopeful that even against the mighty Dodgers, we may have half a chance. It's just how well our starting rotation is going. Ian Anderson is the first pitcher in baseball history with four scoreless starts of at least four innings within his first five career postseason starts. Hard to remember, he was a rookie last season. And if the starting pitching continues as well, then Atlanta do have a chance. And as we know, we're recording this on Sunday night. They are 1-0 in the championship series against the Dodgers. But you want to make a point, JC, about the home field advantage that Atlanta have benefited from, being the divisional winners over the wildcard team that was, of course, the Dodgers, who won 106 games. And that is, what, 18 games more than the Atlanta Braves.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm sounding like a, you know, a bit of a crank here on this because we discussed this previously. And perhaps, you know, I one thing that I'd said was that I thought that teams should be reordered so that the wild card, if you had the most amount of wins, you didn't have to go into that wild card game. So the Dodgers with 106 wins shouldn't have played a one game playoff. They should have gone directly to the divisional series, and teams, even if you won a divisional series, who won less, ended up in that game. Fine, you don't like that, I get it. But at least once you get past the wild card game, I do think you should reorder. And the fact that the Braves, the 188 games, gets home field advantage over the Dodgers, who won 106, just doesn't seem right to me. It just, I mean, the differential there is so great that it seems pretty unfair to give that home field advantage just because you won a weaker division.
As you know, we disagree about the whole concept of the wild card element of this point that you just made. But I'm in agreement with you on this. I actually do agree with you that the home field advantage should be with the team that had the most wins. So on this occasion, the Dodgers should have started. So there you go. I know you didn't expect that, but shocking. I do agree with you. Shock horror. I do think you're right.
The one thing we haven't talked about, though, Gouldy, and I know you probably bristle at this one too, is that I think that a lot of fans, particularly 100% nonpartisan fans who don't have a team still in the race, consider the four teams that are still left to be the least compelling four teams. But, you know, you've got Trash Can Gate with the Astros, you have the Dodgers and the Red Sox with these huge sort of very puffed out chest type fan bases. And the Braves, just for whatever reason, aren't as beloved as you know, some of like those, you know, kind of scrappy type teams like the Milwaukee Brewers. What do you think about that?
Well, they're clearly wrong. That's all I think. They clearly don't understand baseball. Very simple. Moving on. Let's talk about the American League Championship Series. So far, as it stands, we're recording Sunday night, the 17th of October. It's all tied in the ALCS, Houston-Boston. I agreed with you going into this that I thought this would be the Astros, and I didn't imagine it'd be more, they would need more than about four games to win it. But my God, Boston last night, what was it, two grand slams in one game? 8-0 after two innings? I mean, they are capable with the bat, Boston. They can surprise. So this one perhaps is going to be more competitive than I gave it credit for.
Yeah, I mean, if Devers is hot, that's huge. And there was a lot of discussion about his shoulder and whether that was going to sort of limit his hitting. But, you know, swung it last night. And again, a short series. I mean, I know it's a 7-game series, but short in the context of baseball. Anything can happen. And the Red Sox seem to be the surprise package of the teams that are left. I know you were going to say it later, but, you know, we did do choices in the four series as to who was going to win. And one person got all four series right.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Moving on.
Yeah. Who was that, Eric? Got them all right.
I don't remember who that was.
Oh, you guys are I never get any love.
Hey, I got three out of four. You know, that's you've got to show me some love for that. Three out of four.
So you won't give the guy who got four out of four love.
But David's not here.
Moving on. National League Championship Series. It's 1-0. Braves winning an absolute thriller. I mean, going down to the wire, won it in the ninth. It doesn't get much better than that. 3-2 ball game. I mean, the trouble with this Dodgers lineup, they're so flipping good that as a Braves fan watching the game, you're just expecting them to score at any point, you know, just assume that no matter how good the pitching is. And it's pretty demoralizing. It's pretty exhausting to watch. So what's your thoughts? If there's only been one game, but I mean, we all know Atlanta took them all the way to a 7-game in the last year's National League Championship Series. Can they do it again? Can they actually turn it around this time?
I mean, this was going to be a tough one for the Dodgers, right? This was a bullpen game for them. And the fact that they kept it that close, now you're going to get into, you know, Walker Buehler, you're going to get into Max Scherzer, you're going to get into Arias all getting their starts. And I do agree with you. I know we talked before the show a little bit about how the Braves have their own big three. But I think that when you match up the pitching and then also the lineups,
yeah.
And when the Dodgers have their big three, they have the advantage of having the slightly better lineup to go along with that. So, yeah, they're the favorites, and that's not surprising because they won 106 games. But again, short series, your Braves certainly have a shot, and they're up 1-0. So,
Eric, I know you're getting pretty furious about one aspect of the TV coverage, particularly with regards to one of our favorite players, who we all think should be in the Hall of Fame, Pete Rose. What's your thoughts? Just expand on that idea.
Yeah, basically, I'm pretty sure that Pete Rose is screaming at his television set saying, "I'm not in the Hall of Fame," but they're putting up betting graphics in between players, in between at-bats. So if anybody's been watching any of the TV coverage, if fans of Fox being quite the culprit, they have whichever batter will come up to bat, there's, oh, so-and-so, Jose Altuve, for example. If you go on to Fox Bet, he's 7-1 to hit a home run at this at-bat. You just think, wow, you're doing this live in the middle of a playoff game. And I think it's very responsible of Major League Baseball allowing this, but we're going to expand on that later on as well. But yeah, I'm not a big fan of in-game betting during the actual broadcast.
And I know you feel strongly on this one, JC.
So strongly on this one. I mean, this is just so rife to have a situation where a player does something that is against the spirit of the game. Prop bets make it the worst because you could just have a pitcher who feels like, okay, I want to win this game. I don't want to ultimately change the outcome of the result. But in the seventh inning, I'm going to walk their number two hitter. And you can easily line that up. You could easily, I mean, this is just, it's just going to be too easy now for things to go south, and it's going to bite baseball in the butt. And it's a money grab.
That's all it is. 1919 all over again.
Yeah. It's, and I mean, it makes it so easy for people to do untoward things. And I know, you know, you said it before, Eric, I mean, Pete Rose, poor guy at this point, it's unbelievable that he got busted for that sort of stuff. Major League Baseball is now profiting off of gambling. And, you know, most of the facts suggest that Rose did bet, but never bet against his team. Yeah. And at this point, where we are in society, if we're going to allow the type of garbage that Eric's talking about, then Pete Rose has got to be in the Hall of Fame.
Seriously, exactly.
And allowed to engage in Major League Baseball again. I mean, that's part of it too. I mean, he's just not even allowed to be involved with the sport that he was a great player. Not necessarily a great guy, but a great player.
Exactly. Moving on.
I can't agree more. Let's move it on. Right, news roundup. As I said before, we've switched everything around. Normally kick things off as our first batter, but of course this is the postseason, and as we know, MLB doesn't allow trades or transactions or whatever or anything indeed that might be non-playoff related to dominate the news headlines. Having said that, they can't impact on firings and deaths, which are all out of their control. And there's certainly been a load of those. So here is the news roundup. We'll start with a firing, and I must admit, I'm a bit surprised by this one. Mike Shildt, of course, the Cardinals manager, was handed his walking papers. This is, of course, after a 90-game win season, winning the wild card, and, of course, that included a 17-game winning streak in the closing stages that took them into the wild card. This is a man who's taken them to the postseason every single year of his tenure. And I was reading what the Cardinal president, John Motsiliak, I believe that's how you pronounce it, who said of his the firing of Mike Shildt earlier in the week. Philosophical difference. Wouldn't go into detail, JC, but philosophical difference in the direction of the team. We decided internally it'd be best to separate now. He's still got a year on his contract. It's going to cost the Cards to give him the hoof. This is a man with a 252, 199, 559 winning percentage record. Are you as surprised by this decision as I am?
Well, it's just a reminder of how much baseball has moved away from the dugout and into the front office in terms of how teams are determining where they play, how they play, who plays. And, you know, this is a perfect instance of that. I mean, the Cards for a long time have been very analytically driven. They've always been really good at pulling prospects up and developing them. Names that may not be huge names ended up becoming very good baseball players. And I think it's heartbreaking. The manager feels like almost a redundant part of the game in certain ways now. When you see a guy like Schlitt have such a great season and a great number of seasons, took him to the playoffs and realized they didn't win a World Series. They only went to one championship series during his tenure. But nevertheless, he deserves credit for that. I hope he gets another managing job. You know, if I remember correctly, he was a lifer with the Cards. So I think hopefully some other organizations will embrace him for the success that he had, because he should get some credit, I believe.
I mean, interesting, the comment about philosophical difference and not going into detail. I think it's pretty obvious why the Yankees, who started a clean house, have made that decision. They have, Boone, the manager, survives, but they've given the hoof to Marcus Thames, the hitting coach, PJ Pilletier, the assistant hitting coach, and Phil Nevin, the third base coach. And it's abundantly clear why the three have been given the hoof, because one, their offensive game has not been anything like as good as it was in previous seasons, and they've had all sorts of problems recording outs from third base to home base. So I'm assuming that's why Phil Nevin has paid the price. So no surprises here, but perhaps you are surprised that the manager has survived.
Yeah, I mean, a few things. First off, everyone was lauding Marcus Thames when there was all that power with the Yankees in 2019. You know, what's changed? Has he become a worse hitting coach all of a sudden? Or have players just not performed up to snuff? I feel like these type of secondary coaching firings where you don't fire the manager is silly, right? Ultimately, the buck stops with the manager, especially when you talk about Phil Nevin. You're right about calls in terms of runners getting thrown out, but I think that one of the criticisms, at least that some of the media in New York were saying about Nevin, was that he was influencing Boone in ways that didn't improve the team. And if that's the case, that's on Boone, right? Boone's his own man. He could have said, you know, Phil, back off. I don't like what you're saying. I'm going in this direction. But to start pointing the fingers elsewhere, the buck should stop with the manager this way, right? If your team's not performing. At the same time, come on, the Yankees did make the playoffs. There are all these expectations that are just so high. And in baseball, I feel like as long as you get to the playoffs, you're doing your job. After that, it's a bit of a crapshoot.
And I do feel for Phil Nevin. I mean, he had a pretty tough year all round. He tested positive for COVID-19, developed a staph infection, lost 20 pounds. So it's been a pretty gropey year for him anyway. And this presumably is the final thread. It must have been a crappy year for him. So anyway, we wish them well if they can seek out new employment in the world of baseball. And we move on. And this is not a firing, but it's a loss. Ray Foss, former MLB catcher, won 2 World Series with the Oakland Athletics, died last week on Wednesday, 74 years old. And it turns out, we were totally unaware of this, his wife Carol, who'd been married to for 51 years, announced that he'd been fighting cancer for 16 years, guys, and never mentioned it. I don't think it was common knowledge.
There are two ways you think of players, right? Their greatness on the field, and are they baseball people? And baseball people means that they imbue all the joy and the spirit of the game. Ray Fosse was one of those guys. As a broadcaster, you just, all these stories coming out of the woodwork about what a good guy he was when he was a broadcaster and working with young broadcasters. As a player, I know as a catcher, when you have a collision at home plate, and Ray Fosse had one of the most iconic collisions at home plate in an All-Star game, which Pete Rose bowled him over the night after they went out to dinner. Talk about adding insult to injury, right? You go out to dinner with the guy and the next night you sort of affect his career. He was an All-Star after that again, but he won 2 World Series. He had won Golden Gloves. So a good player, an even greater baseball guy. And it's just a real loss.
And an Oakland A's broadcaster as well.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, so he's most aligned with the A's, but in 2001, when the Cleveland Indians, another team he played for, announced their top 100 players, I believe, of all time, he was on that list. So, you know, he made an impact both with the A's and with the Cleveland Indians. Played elsewhere as well, but those were the two major teams.
Spent 8 years in Cleveland. The Cleveland Indians that are now, of course, the Cleveland Guardians. Moving on. Oakland saga lingers on. This apparently, a decision is going to be made after the World Series, whether they're going to stay in Oakland or whether they're going to be going to Vegas. It doesn't sound good when the MLB commissioner, Rob Manfred, actually states, and this is his view on the pursuit of a new ballpark in Oakland. Frankly, in some ways, we're not sure we see a path to success in terms of getting something built in Oakland. I mean, is it really his job to be commenting? I mean, we've discussed this already, that this seems like a bit of a game that Oakland are playing in terms of trying to persuade local government to fork out on a, you know, billion-dollar stadium, and then playing Vegas and Oakland off against each other. Should the commissioner be getting weighing in like this?
It is super hard to root for Rob Manfred. I really, you know, I want someone at the till, someone who's running the show, to be a positive influence on baseball. And all I can see between the betting, between his comments like this, it's clear that Major League Baseball wants a team in Vegas. They think that's a great market, especially with their gambling. And they never thought Oakland was a great market. So it's about sort of the dollars and cents of it all, not about what is great for the history and legacy of baseball. And Manfred consistently seems to come out on the wrong side of that. He was at an interview at a big convention recently, and I know we saw an article on this, where he was talking about the regional sports nets and talking about not supporting some of them like Sinclair, because they want, Major League Baseball wants to retain control of that direct activity, whether it's gambling or certain elements where they can make money. It just feels like a money grab more than any commissioner previous. There's less of a look on what is best for baseball and more of a consideration on what is best for the owners and their bottom line. And I understand, in a way, that's his role, right? He's hired by the owners to be that commissioner for them. But in the past, there was much more of a balance of what's good for the game. And consistently, it doesn't seem that Rob Manfred gets that.
Do you miss Bud Selig?
I'm shocked to say this, but I'd have to say yes.
I mean, even me.
I mean, there's a long line of commissioners who I didn't like. I mean, Bowie Kuhn did some stuff to minor league baseball that I didn't like, to professionalize it a little more, but I loved having that really broad, decentralized minor league baseball. That was Bowie Kuhn. He did some stuff, obviously, there, commissioners, you know, Kenesaw Mountain Landis and issues with segregation. But we're kind of, you know, Manfred may be in the Hall of Shame for commissioners if he keeps going like this and not keep his eye on what's best for baseball rather than what's best for the financial bottom line.
Okay, well, let's continue the Manfred story, because that's the last of story of the news roundup. And that is the recent CAA World Congress, where Commissioner Rob Manfred publicly bashed the Sinclair Broadcast Group during an appearance at the Congress of Sports, offering rare and pointed criticism of the company that holds the local rights to 14 MLB teams. Asked about Sinclair's claim that it is close to obtaining the necessary rights to launch a direct-to-consumer RSN service, none of which I understand, Manfred said that the accurate statement would be that Sinclair does not have enough digital rights from enough clubs in order to have a viable direct-to-consumer product. He went on to say the other set of rights they've talked a lot about is gambling rights, coming back to what you were saying earlier, JC, and they don't have those either.
Yeah, I mean, I alluded to that just a moment ago, Gouldie, and they're talking about regional sports nets. So it's having the ability to broadcast in the regional networks. And you can see the Major League Baseball wants to try and pull back all the rights they possibly can do. And this goes back to another story we saw earlier this year with Major League Baseball taking away the rights from Topps and handing it over to another organization, primarily so that they, Major League Baseball, could retain a larger piece of that pie. Every decision they're making is about consolidating power now. It's not about Topps has been this iconic brand that's great for baseball, or regional Sportsnet has been part of the fabric of local coverage. All that's out the door. It's about how can we pull back more power so that we can figure out ways to keep money in-house more. And they've done the math, and the math says that that's the best way for them to make money rather than selling out licensing rights. And it's sad. I don't like it, because I like a little bit more decentralized voices. Because when you get a singular voice, it becomes a little too selfish about trying to serve their needs.
Do you believe that this is truly ripping up the culture of baseball, and therefore long-term this could have major implications?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are marketing issues with baseball that aren't related to this that really need to be solved, about bringing up players and making them look like the heroes, or at least bringing attention to them the way other sports do. But this is a huge issue too. I sort of feel that the consolidation of power with Major League Baseball to take everything in-house is going to, especially with the current leadership, may make them more money in the short term, but will not do right by baseball in the long term.
Okay, pretty depressing note to finish the news roundup on. Let's move it on. It's time for the seventh inning stretch. Eric, we haven't given you much chance to have your say, but you've certainly got your say this week. We have finally discovered the book that you lost on the Northern Line.
Yes, I was on my way to Lost Property at London Underground, or Lost or Found, as we call it in North America. And guess what? On my way to Baker Street, where Lost Properties is, I went to my bag and I found it was in another compartment in my bag, which is Memories from the Microphone by Kurt Smith. A book, as I mentioned last week, that I thought I had lost, but found and finished. And it's a fascinating book on the history of broadcasting in of baseball games. And we missed out on the 100th anniversary of the first radio broadcast of a major baseball game. And it was in August of 1921, where at Forbes Field, the Pirates were playing the Phillies. And a guy by the name of Harold Arlen, all he did is he took a plank, he bought a box seat, sat behind home plate, had a telephone line with a cord that would reach his box seat, and with a scorecard. And all he did was he talked through the radio, which was linked to a radio station, and apparently it was the most boring broadcast ever, because he had no model to go on. So he was the first ever baseball broadcaster. And all he said was like, that was a pitch, and that was a strike. And then the next pitch, 15 seconds later, and that was a ball. And then there was no like, you know, banter with anybody. But that was the first broadcast of a baseball game. And then that sort of spawned into, because pre-1921, it was all print. It was all hearsay of what happened. But it opened the ears and minds of people to go to baseball games. And then, of course, that went on into... To what, let's face it, I think of all the sports, and I mean, I guess I can be biased here. I think of all the sports out there, baseball's the most romantic one to listen to on the radio. Is it not? Josh, you agree with me there?
I mean, I agree with you. I don't know how much of that is our own biases from our childhood. So, you know, we're sort of locked into that nostalgia of that. But yeah, for me, I remember being a kid at night in bed listening to like the equivalent of a transistor radio. So for me,
we've lost that actually. I mean, obviously the irony of us doing a podcast and talking about this is another story, but we'll get into that later. But you know, you look at things like, you know, there was a channel called KDKA that started off this whole thing. They had KMOX, KMOX from St. Louis, that would actually go on to nationally broadcast baseball games with people like Harry Carey and Jack Buck and Mel Allen. Those were the voices of baseball, voices of the nation. And also nationally, it has waned from the collective consciousness, I'd say. You know, like, announcers are not taught to be entertaining anymore. It's all about analytics and all about, you know, I guess I'm being biased, or maybe I'm being too romantic, but you know, even
we took a dark turn in this episode.
We sure have. It's like, we're not trying to say baseball sucks. It's not what it used to be, but you know, you look back at like even the golden age television, you know, the book goes on about how, you know, the, you know, 1939 World Fair, in New York, they show this thing called television, and how do you convince people like, yeah, you should buy a television. Well, let's show a doubleheader between the Cincinnati Reds and the Brooklyn Dodgers, beg your pardon. And that was, you know, baseball was used as a selling point for technology back then. And did you know, 1959, first time that they used instant replay. All in this book, Memories from the Microphone by Chris Smith. Highly recommended, apparently highly recommended as an Audible book as well, because they'll throw in some Mel Allen and Harry Carey and Vin Scully from the golden age of radio and television.
Kurt Smith's a good baseball author. He wrote a book about presidents in the past time as well too. He's a pretty prominent baseball author. So worth your time. He has a track record.
And by the way, just out of curiosity, since we're British based here in the United Kingdom, well, two of us out of the three are, the first sports broadcast on radio in the United Kingdom, Johnny, do you know what it is?
Nope.
1927.
I have no idea. I have no significant sporting activity in 1927. You tell me.
It was England, Wales, and Twickenham.
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, look at that. Now I'm.
Yeah, I don't even. Okay, so you're introducing the rugby.
All right, everyone needs to drink now. We went back to rugby.
I didn't know that. Okay,
that was the first sports event broadcast on a radio in the United Kingdom, and the BBC was England, Wales, 1920, from Twickenham. There you go. Chelsea.
But there had been images. You know, the oldest baseball image in the UK was 1906, something like that. It was the British National Championship. And I've posted it on Twitter before, showing images from the first decade of the 20th century. So it wasn't a broadcast of the game, but it was certainly images of sport.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with microphones, does it? No.
All right, Eric.
I'll tell you what else has nothing to do with microphones, and that's websites, JC. You wanted to, now that we're talking book of the week, you also want to expand that concept.
Yeah, so I thought maybe it might be valuable, at least for this week and perhaps in the future, to talk about some websites that are really worth checking out that are of value to our listeners. And one that I really like is umpirescorecards.com. You can also follow them on Twitter and get this information. And they do a fantastic job of determining the performance of umpires in major league games. They'll give you a percentage of how often the umpire called a strike correctly for the traditional strike zone, but then also what their established strike zone is, how often they were in an established strike zone. And what I mean by that is that even though we have the strike zone, you know, from the width of the plate and from the letters to the knees, every umpire has a slightly different strike zone. And to me, that's the important strike zone. As long as you're consistent in what you call, even if it's not what the traditional strike zone is, it's okay. It's when you start getting outside of that. And they'll give you a percentage on both. They'll tell you the worst mistakes that the umpire has made, which is really fascinating. And then they'll tell you what difference those mistakes made in terms of the score of the game. So they somehow have some sort of statistic to say, the Atlanta Braves were advantaged by 0.63 runs by all the calls in the game. So it's a wonderfully interesting and illuminating website, and I recommend it.
Okay. Well, that's website number one. We'll perhaps add a few more in future broadcasts. Baseball cultural reference of the week, Eric. Moving on, what have you got for us this week?
Well, by the way, I know that last week we discussed Danny Kaye and the Dodgers song which Johnny absolutely loved. The one thing I neglected, I was going to mention on the show, and I completely forgot until one of our listeners on Twitter reminded me. So, Eric, why didn't you mention the fact that Danny Kaye was one of the founding members of the Seattle Mariners? So, oh my God, yes, I was going to mention that. So, Danny Kaye was responsible for the Seattle Mariners to, you know, in 1977, be established in Major League Baseball, who also, by the way, wore the same color motif as the Seattle Pilots, as Milwaukee Brewers, as an homage to the failed Pilots franchise. So 1977, you just look at the Seattle Mariners uniform, and it was a throwback to the Seattle Pilots. There you go. But moving on, speaking of anniversaries, you know, pop culture, it's also the anniversary, albeit, you know, not a round number anniversary, but the 83rd anniversary last week of the Abbott and Costello routine of who's on first. Now, I'm going to be honest here. When I was a kid growing up, and even in my teens, I actually found that skit and that routine pretty damn annoying. I said, this is not funny. But I always felt it was too long. But then as you grow older, and you listen to it again, it's like, my God, the timing and the comedic genius of that was absolutely astronomical. You know, it was basically two guys who, Abbott and Costello, legendary comedians in the 30s, October 6th, which was a few weeks ago, they did the first routine on radio. And it sounded something like this.
Are you the manager?
Yes.
You're going to be the coach too?
Yes.
And you know the fellow's name?
Oh, I should.
Well, then who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first baseman.
Who?
The guy playing
who
first.
Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who?
Yes.
Look, you got a first baseman?
Certainly.
Who's playing first?
That's right.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it.
All I'm trying to find out is the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The guy that gets the
That's
money.
That's it.
Who gets the money on
he
first?
He does, every dollar. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. What's wrong with that?
Look, all I want to know is when you sign up the first baseman, how does he sign his name to
who?
The contract? The guy.
Who?
How does he sign his
That's
name?
That's how he signs it.
Who?
Yes.
All I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base?
No, what is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
One base at a time.
Well, don't change the players.
I'm not changing nobody.
Take it easy, buddy.
I'm only asking you, who's the guy on first base?
That's right.
Okay.
All right.
I mean, what's the guy's name on first base?
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on
who's
second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Oh, he's on third. We're not talking about him. Now, let's begin.
How did I get on third base?
Why, you mentioned his name.
If I mention a third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
What's on first?
What's on second?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go, back on third again.
Look,
will you stay on third base and don't go off it?
All right, I don't even know.
Now, who's playing third base?
Why do you insist on putting who on third base?
What am I putting on third?
What is on second?
You don't want who on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know. Third base!
And it goes on and on. You know, we'll play, Johnny will link to it later on in the show. But I just want to, you know, it is, you just listen to that. The timing, just to rehearse that and get it down to a T without faltering is quite comedic genius.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the speed of the banter is what really always marveled me about that, how they go back and forth so quickly from the various positions and the misunderstanding. And of course, eventually in Major League Baseball, there was a player who came up through the Dodgers organization. I think he played for the Rangers briefly. He was a Taiwanese player and his last name was Hu. And so there was a popular meme that went around that said, after 70 years, who is finally on first base?
Very good. It's something about baseball, though, isn't it? I mean, one, we've talked about this many times, the fact that there are more great baseball movies than any other sport probably put together. But there's also these cultural references, comedic sketches. I mean, what is it about baseball that just seems to lend itself?
Well, I have a theory on this. So, you know, I wrote a book on the history of sports metaphors. And one thing that I saw consistently among the ones in North America were the three sports stood out as having the greatest number of sports metaphors or idioms. Idioms are sort of metaphors that everyone understands. And the three were horse racing, boxing, and baseball. And the reason those three, in my mind, were the most popular is because before the period that Eric was talking about, that period of broadcast, all of these sports were determined and described by writers, right? There were writers in the first part of the 20th century, Damon Runyon, Ring Lardner, these great names, great writers who wrote about these three sports and really created an image that when you talk about it, doesn't even do it justice. These guys were better writers than even the great broadcasters were. And they created these great heroes. And that, because that's, you know, such part of the literary tradition that these guys were. Sports writers back then were incredibly literate. And so they wrote about it in this broad, beautiful way that really got those sports going. And so the difference between baseball, horse racing, and boxing is that horse racing, even though it's a sport of kings, and boxing, ironically, because we're talking a lot about gambling, they sort of receded a lot because they became more gambling sports. They didn't stay on the front burner. Baseball just continued to ascend where those two sports started to contract a little bit. And I think that the combination of those things, that it had that great basis of literary writing on it, and it continued to grow into the 50s and the 60s before it started to contract itself, really lends itself for it being such a sport of nostalgia and such a sport of history.
One more thing as well, I wanted to, it's interesting you say about like people would understand, especially in that era, baseball metaphors or but a friend of mine from Canada, he went to Japan to teach English to Japanese students, as some people did in their early 20s. And he said he met an American teacher was doing the same thing, and he said he used the Abbott Costello Who's on First routine and recording to teach Japanese kids English, because it was a crossover of baseball and English and who and what, I don't know, et cetera, et cetera. And I found that fascinating, using Abbott Costello's Who's on First as a teaching tool to Japanese students.
You wouldn't find Les Dawson sketches being used to teach Japanese students, that's for sure, yeah. Okay, well, let's move it on. Trivia question, quick reminder, big guy.
I need to give you a trivia answer. Or you need, no, you need to give me a trivia answer, by the way.
It's late, isn't it?
It's late, we've been working, Johnny's been sick, I've been working 88 hours. I asked you earlier, which of these four teams actually has the most retired numbers? Was it A, New York Yankees? Was it B, the Montreal Canadiens? Or was it C, the Chicago Bears? Or was it D, the Boston Celtics? One from each of the four major sports in North America, ladies and gentlemen. But are there any red herrings in there, or is there a rhyme and reason that I did that? Who would like to go first?
Well, my logic in these things, as you know, is to always ignore the most obvious. But on this occasion, I'm going to do the exact opposite. So I'm going with the Yankees. This is a baseball broadcast. There's only one baseball reference. So I'm going with the baseball reference. So I'm deciding the Yankees is my choice.
First, a clarity, it's numbers, not players, right? Because the Yankees had two, right? Because they had two number innings retired.
Very well thought out. As the answer is actually numbers, not players. Montreal, gotcha. For example, has two as well.
I know that the Celtics have a ton of retired numbers. It was like a crazy number, which is shocking because of their roster size. I like Goldie's thinking on this. I know it's close. Whatever the number is, it's going to be close between the Yankees and the Celtics would be my guess. But I'll go with the Yankees as well, Goldie. I'll stick with you, buddy.
I'm loving that, big guy. I feel a lot more confident now.
Did we get it right? We got it right together last time, I think.
We did, absolutely.
So maybe we'll go down together today.
It's family show. In no particular order, the Chicago Bears, 14.
Oh.
The New York Yankees, 21. The Montreal Canadiens, another historical franchise, only 15. The Boston Celtics, 23.
No!
Wow.
As well, on top of that,
so close,
Kevin Garnett will have his retired number this season, and he'll be 24
So I knew the Celtics had a ton. But it is, like you said,
it's ridiculous for, so, you know, they don't have a huge roster.
Jesse, all credit to you. You said they were the top two. You were right. You just chose the wrong one, buddy. Don't be hard on yourself.
Okay? I wanted to be on your team, Goldie.
I noticed.
Like, after all these years, I felt like for once I wanted to be on your
and
team.
And by the way, just a little throw me in there, out of the four sports there, which of those four sports were the first to introduce retiring numbers?
Baseball.
It's actually Ace Bailey of the Toronto Maple Leafs, 1934.
NHL,
first,
okay.
Yeah, NHL, and then all the other teams, leagues went, hey, that's a good idea. Let's retire numbers.
Yeah. I feel like that's the ultimate in terms, you know, Hall of Fame's great, whatever, but to retire your number, that no one else will wear your number again, that to me is the greatest tip of the cap.
There you go. Bailey's P. Rose has that. So yeah.
I mean, in a sense, we all were retired by Channel 5, just not quite our numbers.
It's not willingly.
Yes. Okay, moving on. Onto the mailbag. I've got a couple of good tweets here. Christopher Kamka tweets, Wilmer Flores, and this is obviously with regards to the Czech swing, is now 0-18 with a walk and 9 strikeouts career v. Max Scherzer. He would have been out eventually anyway, if those numbers are anything to go by. Probably quite a good point. UK Braves. On Twitter, my opinion on Czech swings aside, this is all baseball's fault for having literally no consensus on what is a Czech swing and what isn't. And that was the point you were making, Josh, that it's too subjective. They need to be more clearly defined. And one last thing I want to ask you guys. Alyssa Cohen says, according to the MLB News Network, the Rays have made it known they're open to moving Manuel Margot, Kevin Kiermaier, and Tyler Glasnow in the offseason. If that's true, and you would have thought the source is pretty good, that's pretty shocking, isn't it?
You say that, but right, the rotation in the postseason included none of the pitchers who threw for the team that went to the World Series the year before. I mean, the Rays are amazing in the ability to turn over their roster and still be competitive. So of any team, I'm least surprised when they're sort of clearing house and still believing they can be competitive.
Let's see if they can settle down in Montreal next season.
Okay, well, obviously, we'd love to hear from you. As always, we need you to pump us up on the social media front, the Johnny and Josh Show on Twitter, on Facebook, off to my side, down the bottom, wherever they are, pointy. We do want to get involved as well in the world of fantasy baseball. I know we've not had a behind home plate for a couple of weeks since the postseason started, basically because fantasy baseball comes to a crashing end in the postseason. But we will be doing a roundup show, and I'll give you plenty of warning when that's happening. And that is, of course, at BHP Pod with Jimbo and myself, James Holden, the fantasy legend. That Coombs Show is kicking off at the NC Show. Nat, of course, boys, was covering the London game today.
NFL,
if you saw the NFL. So congratulations to Nat. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on YouTube, we're everywhere. That's it from us, though, for this week. Do love having you here. Anything exciting to look forward to? Any more curling, JC?
Yes, but more at a local level. You know, we did well in our final shot at the Olympics, did not make it. And so now I'm just kind of enjoying the game for the game's sake.
So you're basically down, you were potentially in the Premiership, you're back down League Two. Is that what you're saying?
They say my team is on the precipice of maybe breaking apart. If we stay together, we have one more shot at making it to Nationals. So I'm trying to hold the boat together because I want to take one more shot at that. I'm trying to be.
You're the glue.
I'm not usually good at that, though. You know, I don't have your charisma, Goldie.
Do you want me to come out? Do you want me to have a chat with the boys?
Yeah, maybe you could be like our mediator, come in and just get it all together.
Just give them my credentials. 13-year head coach of the legendary Caution Cobras. Triple, double, county champion.
I feel like if I brought you in, you'd end up auctioning off one of our players.
What about you, Eric? You've been busy.
Actually, yesterday I was working on the EFL highlights on Quest with our good friend Colin Murray, who's a notorious a Toronto Blue Jays fan. And today I did non-league football, so I'm really tired and running on fumes.
Well, we appreciate your efforts, big guy. And you, of course, also, JC. Our love to the family. Thank you for listening. You've been listening to The Johnny and Josh Show. We'll be back next weekend. Same time, same place. Look forward to having your company. Till then, best of luck to the Braves. We'll leave you with the full sketch of Abbott and Costello.
Well, Costello, I'm going to New York with you. You know, Bucky Harris, the Yanks manager, gave me a job as coach for as long as you're on the team.
Look, Abbott,
If you're a coach, you must know all the players.
I certainly do.
Well, you know, I never met the guys, so you'll have to tell me their names, and then I'll know who's playing on the team.
Oh, I'll tell you their names, but you know, strange it may seem, they give these ball players nowadays very peculiar names.
You mean funny names?
Strange names, pet names, like Dizzy Dean and...
His brother Daffy.
Daffy Dean.
And their French cousin.
French?
Gouffet.
Gouffet Dean, oh, I see. Well, let's see, we have on the bags, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know is on third.
That's what I want to find
out. I say, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know is on third.
Are you the manager?
Yes.
You're going to be the coach too?
Yes.
And you know the fellow's name?
Well, I should.
Well, then who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first baseman.
Who?
The guy playing
who
first.
Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who?
Yes.
Look, you got a first baseman?
Certainly.
Who's playing first?
That's right.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it.
All I'm trying to find out is the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The guy that gets the
That's
money.
That's it.
Who gets the money on
he
first?
He does, every dollar. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. What's wrong with that?
Look, all I want to know is when you sign up the first baseman, how does he sign his name to
who?
The contract? The guy.
Who?
How does he sign his
That's
name?
That's how he signs it.
Who?
Yes.
All I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base.
No, what is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
One base at a time.
Well, don't change the players.
I'm not changing nobody.
Take it easy, buddy.
I'm only asking you, who's the guy on first base?
That's right.
Okay.
All right.
Name on first base.
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on
who's
second.
Who's on third?
I don't know.
Oh, he's on third. We're not talking about him. Now, let's begin.
Now, how did I get on third base?
Why, you mentioned his name.
If I mention a third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
What's on first?
What's on second?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go, back on third again. Will you stay on third base
right.
And don't go off it?
All right, nobody will know.
Now, who's playing third base?
Why do you insist on putting who on third base?
What am I putting on third?
What is on second?
You don't want who on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know.
Third base!
You got outfield?
Sure.
The left fielder's name.
Why?
I just thought I'd ask.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Now tell me who's playing left field.
Who is playing first?
I'm not. Stay out of the infield. I want to know what's the guy's name in left field.
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know. Third base. And the left fielder's name?
Why?
Because.
Oh, he's center field.
He's field.
Look,
you got a pitcher on the team.
Sure.
The pitcher's name.
Tamara.
You don't want to tell me today?
I'm telling you,
then
man.
Go ahead.
Tamara.
What time?
What time what?
What time tomorrow you're going to tell me who's pitching?
Now listen, who is not pitching?
I'll break your arm, you say, who's on first. I want to know what's the pitcher's name.
What's on second?
I don't know.
Third base.
Got a catcher?
Certainly.
The catcher's name.
Today.
Today. And tomorrow's pitcher.
Now you've got it.
All we got is a couple of days on the team. You know, I'm a catcher, too.
So they tell me.
I get behind the plate, do some fancy catching. Tomorrow's pitching on my team, and a heavy hitter gets up.
Yes.
Now, the heavy hitter bunts the ball. When he bunts the ball, me being a good catcher, I want to throw the guy out of first base, so I pick up the ball and throw it to who?
Now, that's the first thing you've said right.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Well, that's all you have to do.
Just to throw the ball to first base.
Yes.
Now, who's got it?
Naturally.
I throw the ball to first base, somebody's got to get it. Now, who has it?
Naturally.
Who?
Naturally.
Naturally?
Naturally.
So I pick up the ball and I throw it to naturally.
No, you don't. You throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
That's different.
That's what I said.
You're not saying that.
I throw the ball to naturally.
You throw it to who?
Naturally.
That's it.
That's what I said.
Listen, you ask me.
I throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
Now you ask me.
You throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
That's it.
Same as you.
Don't change them around.
Same as you.
Go ahead, now get it over.
I throw the ball to who? Whoever it is drops the ball and the guy runs a second.
Yes.
Who picks up the ball and throws it to what? What throws it to, I don't know. I don't know, throws it back to tomorrow. Triple play.
Yes.
Another guy gets up and it's a long fly ball to because. Why? I don't know. He's on third and I don't give a darn.
What?
I said I don't give a darn.
Oh, that's our shortstop.
I'm an idiot. Come on.